Born to a poor cobbler, he rose to become the undisputed ruler of the biggest nation on earth and to attempt a world revolution. With us today, the man who knows Joseph Stalin perhaps better than anyone ever has, Stephen Kotkin, author of Stalin. Uncommon Knowledge Now. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. The John P. Berkland Professor in History and International Affairs at Princeton University, Stephen Kotkin, is also a fellow at the Hoover Institution here at Stanford. Dr. Kotkin is the author of a number of books, most recently, Stalin, Paradoxes of Power, 1878 to 1928. Note that this book is volume one of a projected three-volume series about Joseph Stalin and his time. The review in the New York Times called Stalin, quote, masterful, close quote, which shows that even the New York Times can from time to time get something just exactly right. Stephen Kotkin, welcome.
Thank you, Peter.
First things first, Stalin, volume one, Paradoxes of Power, 1878 to 1928. He's born in 1878. Got it. Why do you end volume one in 1928?
1928 is when Stalin makes the decision to collectivize agriculture, or that is to enslave the peasantry, 100 million plus people in Eurasia. And the question is, not only why did he do that, but how was it possible that he could accumulate the power to be able to enslave 100 million people? So the book tries to put in context this decision, the so-called collectivization of agriculture, and to give it a sense of the sweep of Russian history, the geopolitics of the time, Stalin's personality, and of course the mechanisms of power.
All right. Let me quote the book to you, Stephen. Stalin, quote, subjects of biography often are portrayed as forming their personalities, including their views about authority and obedience, that is, about power, in childhood, and especially the family. But do we really need to locate the wellsprings of Stalin's politics or even his troubled soul in beatings he allegedly received as a child in Gori? Close quote. Begin with a little boy in Gori.
You know, so Stalin is born in a market town. It's not a big city, but it's also not a complete backwater. It's an ancient trading center on the trade routes, Near East, Europe, Russia. And in that market town, his parents are strivers. The father is a cobbler who's looking to become a kind of self-standing artisan with his own business. The mother takes various different jobs in order to help with the education of her child. Because of the Russian Orthodox Church, which generally is not a front and center story among Russian historians, because of the Russian Orthodox Church, there's a school in the town, as a result of which there's the possibility of a future for the young kids.
Because little Yosef Djugashvili learns to read and write at a time when that might not have been standard?
It's the Russian Orthodox Church, and he's Georgian. So his native language is Georgian. But his mother sends him to a priest who has several sons, and that priest teaches him Russian. And so he's able, on the basis of this knowledge of Russian, to enter the school. In fact, he does well at the school.
How closely related are the two languages? Is this like Italian and Spanish?
No, they're not related at all. They're two entirely different languages, and knowing one helps you nothing with learning the other.
So that was an...
So it's a big accomplishment. He does very well at school. He studies hard. He's the teacher's pet. He sings in the choir. He wants to become a priest or a monk, which is not unusual for outstanding students in a parish school run by the church. There's no university in the Caucasus. The Tsarist regime is afraid of university students because university students have their own ideas, including ideas about politics. And so they refuse to open a university locally. And so the highest educational institutions locally are the gymnasium, or the elite high schools, and the seminary, the Orthodox seminary, where they train priests in Tiflis, which is the capital of Georgia and the capital of the South Caucasus. Mm-hmm. And Stalin gets admitted into the seminary. which is not easy. And in fact, he gets a state scholarship because he's an outstanding student. He then, once again, does very well at school, near the top of his class. Again, the teacher's pet. Teacher's pet means, of course, that he snitches on the other students, as you know from school yourself, right? And, however, he ends up giving all of that up. He's on the pathway to success. He's got a bright future. But instead, he joins the revolutionary underground,
right,
and spends the next two decades of his life on the run, in prison, in exile.
Stop there.
Without money.
Before we get him into the seminary, I just want to make sure I understand this correctly. So even as, for example, if you read up on the early years of Ronald Reagan, you see right from the get-go charm.
Yes.
People liked him from the time he was a little kid.
Yes.
And with Stalin, what you see right from the get-go is smarts and a certain ambition. Is that right?
Correct. He's often the leader of the stuff that happens in the streets. You know, kids play in the street. Every kid growing up in this epoch is playing in the streets. But he's often the self-appointed or the chosen leader of the group of children. He's not physically as adept as some of the other kids. Some accidents have happened to him. He's got a couple of birth defects.
How big is he? How tall is he?
He's about 5'7", eventually, as a fully grown adult. He's a slight child, but he's stocky, he's wiry and muscular. He's one of the smaller kids at school. He's about 2 inches shorter than Hitler, if people know Hitler's height.
All right.
Hitler's not a giant either. Hitler's about 5'9", but Stalin's about
5'7". Churchill's about 5'6", as I recall. Is that
yes.
right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
So it's not especially small, but he's not very large either. But he's physically active.
So, in other words, what we're talking about is force of personality, not a physical presence.
Yes, force of personality and ambition. Mm-hmm. And the ambition expresses itself through reading and acquiring knowledge and bettering himself. He wants to be somebody of significance. And being somebody of significance through education, that obviously comes from his mother, very strongly stressing education for him. Now, there are all sorts of stories about Stalin's childhood. These stories are mostly reminiscences of people later in life. So after he's murdered many, many hundreds of thousands of people, they remember, I knew when we were on the playground when he was 11 and he said, I'm going to get all you guys, that he was going to kill everybody in the country, right? So those reminiscences fill up a lot of the biographies. Some of them could be true, but I refuse to use any of them. The only sources I'll use about Stalin are the ones where it's said in real time and recorded in real time. What did they say about him in 1915? What did they say about him in 1920, in 1925?
Right. So back to the seminary, because it could almost be the case, I find myself thinking as I'm reading that early chapter, he's just going to use the seminary to get ahead. But that isn't quite, you push against that. This is one place where you do quote a later reminiscence, but it seems to fit the evidence of the time.
Yes.
Stalin was very much a believer. This is someone later remembering what it was like in the old days. Stalin was very much a believer, going to all the services, singing the church choir. He not only observed all religious rites, but always reminded us to observe them.
Yes.
And he goes in a real believer and comes out a communist. How did that happen? Yeah, that's the moment, right?
That's certainly a great story. I'll use the reminiscences if there's more than one of them, if
okay.
they're backed up by another one. And moreover, remembering that he was religious is something that is published while he's a communist dictator. And so if it's published while he's a communist dictator, it goes against the communist militant godlessness. And so it rings of truth because it doesn't fit the regime right. ideology
Testimony
or image of him.
Testimony against interest, so to speak.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
So what happens is Tsarist Russia is not a pretty place. It's very oppressive. Politics are illegal. They don't have a parliament. They don't have a constitution. Until 1905-06, after losing the war with the Japanese, they don't have a legal parliament. You cannot participate in politics. And so if you don't like what you see, if you see injustice, if you see incompetence, if you see embezzlement, there's kind of no way to organize against it. Because all political activity, as I said, is illegal. And so under these circumstances, you get a revolutionary underground, meaning opposition to Tsarist regime, social injustice, and incompetence takes the form of underground politics, not always because of choice, but because there's kind of no other option. And even when the Tsar will grant a constitution and a quasi-parliament, the 1905-06 events, still many things are illegal, censorship, political associations, which are not sanctioned by the authorities. So there's a very large population of people who feel the Tsarist regime is oppressive and want to do something about it, and they enter the revolutionary. So he does that too. But remember, it's a risk. Mm-hmm. He's giving up a successful life, a successful trajectory, for a life of fighting for justice, but that's not a profession. That's not going to pay him a salary. That's not going to make him the owner of a house or a farm or anything else. And so he's going to lead a life of impoverishment, of prison and exile, of police harassment and persecution for more than 20 years, essentially, from about 1898, well, 19 years, till 1917, right? When unexpectedly there's a revolution in Russia, but right. No one expected that to happen. So it's a big commitment to be an underground revolutionary fighting for social justice because you see that the Tsarist regime
it wasn't
oppressive.
A phase. He wasn't just a hot-headed young man. He didn't grow out of it. It became a permanent commitment.
Some people did give it up,
so,
but he didn't.
Obviously, we need to come to the revolution, which is worth shows and shows and volumes on its own. We need to do that briefly. But before we get to the revolution, I don't even know how to frame the question tightly. How bad was the Tsarist regime? I've always been struck that Stalin is placed in exile in Siberia half a dozen times.
Yeah.
And it seems to be the case he's able to wander off. They're not
yes.
that, I mean, politics may be illegal, but it almost seems a little bit unserious. To exile, this is the fifth time we're saying, this is like, they're no more serious about their revolutionaries than we are about visa holders in this country, right?
Yeah, but they didn't have telephones.
Right.
And the distances are very large, the communications are very primitive, and the officials are susceptible to bribery. In addition to the fact that they drink and may be incompetent, the Tsarist regime is a failure. It cannot live up to its own aims and ambitions. It wants to be one of the great powers in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And being one of the great powers in the world means competing with Britain, competing with France, right? Competing with Germany. Tsarist Russia's better government raises more revenue, bigger army, more competent administration than the Ottoman Empire, than the Qing Dynasty in China. But that's not the league it's playing in. It's playing in the absolute top leagues. And the pressure to play in that top league with a less educated population, a less literate population, with a great deal more territory to cover, and overall with less industry and modernity to compete. And so the Tsarist regime is in a pressure cooker. It's fighting for its survival when it wants to be, it has the ambitions of being one of the great powers. Now, inside that, it's got these opponents. The opponents are not only the revolutionaries in the underground.
Mm-hmm.
The opponents are in the establishment. One of the stories about the revolution that I try to tell is revolutions happen when the establishment revolts against the political system. People in the street can revolt or not revolt. Peasants, workers can go on strike or rebel. That's not a revolution. A revolution is when your establishment cuts and runs. And the Tsarist regime loses its establishment. This means that it's not as tight as an authoritarian regime would be today.
When you say it loses its establishment, you're talking about rich landholders who have big houses in Petersburg and Moscow. You're talking about the top army officials.
Yes.
You're talking about the handful of industrialists.
Yes.
It's a very small elite given that, by contrast with the size of the country, maybe a few hundred families intermarried and so forth. He loses them?
Yes, and the ministers, the local governors, for example, right? If you feel that the regime is incompetent, if you feel that the regime loses a war with Japan, which is an Asiatic country, as they said at the time, right? You begin to lose confidence in the ability of this regime going forward, and you might not go out on a limb to the same extent. In addition, the officials that are in the far-off remote locales are not your best people. They're in far-off locales often because they're not as good as those officials who have been drawn to provincial capitals, let alone the court society. And so many of the police that Stalin deals with are local people who have some education, 2 or 3 years, or no education.
And his, he can take them because he's smarter and tougher and more ambitious.
He sweet-talks them, or he outsmarts them, or he bribes them, or he just manages somehow to collude with other officials to get. And so this back and forth, in and out of exile, is not a sign that the Tsarist regime didn't take the prisoners seriously. It's a sign that the prisoners were not so stupid, the officials were not so competent, and overall, the regime had a brittleness, a rickety quality. And so this didn't mean that the revolutionaries were going to come to power, right? Most people assumed that the constitutionalists would come to power, those people that we would call the liberal in the classical sense, for rule of law, private property, you know, constitutional Democrats, as the party was called. This was the vision that most people had for changing Tsarist Russia. Some had the revolutionary socialist vision, but they were in the underground, in Siberia, in European exile, right? They were oppressed by the police.
Now, I'm going to do it something very dirty, which is try to compress into three sentences volumes of history. 1905, revolution takes place, a Duma is established, the Tsar grants it official standing, there's back and forth. Is this society going to become liberal in the classical sense? Is it going to become parliamentary like the great nations of Western Europe, or is it not? It doesn't work very well, and then the whole experiment gets buried in the with the outbreak of the First World War. Fair enough, crude, but fair enough for at top speed.
You got it, Peter.
Okay. And then in 1917, the country suffers not one, but two revolutions. Can you distinguish for us the February from the October revolutions of 1917?
1917 revolutions take place during the war. World War I is still going. Now, the Germans are going to win on the Eastern Front. This is something people forget. In March 1918, there's going to be a peace treaty acknowledging German victory in World War I.
So, Brest-Litovsk.
Brest-Litovsk Treaty, you're exactly right. But until then, right, the war is continuing. So the revolutionary events take place during the war. Because the perception is the Tsarist regime, and especially Nicholas II, the Tsar, are not managing the war properly, the generals begin to think that they need to restore order, get a grip on the situation politically in order to win the war effort. Now, the generals are not looking for power themselves. It's not a military coup. They latch on to a faction inside the Duma or the quasi-parliament. But it's the generals who talk Nicholas II into abdicating. Now, they think he should abdicate in favor of his son, who's a teenager, but also a hemophiliac. And there's no cure for hemophilia. And if the son bumps into a chair, he can bleed to death. And so Nicholas is very afraid of what could happen to his son. Moreover, a czar who abdicates has to leave the country. And so Nicholas would have to leave his son, Alexei, the teenage hemophiliac, and go into exile, which he refuses to do. So at the last minute, Nicholas, talked into it by his generals, who were trying to preserve the system and fight the war better, while the capital, St. Petersburg, renamed Petrograd during the war, while the capital is in flames, the garrison is in revolt in the capital, Nicholas is at the front, the generals talk him into abdicating, he abdicates at the last minute, he abdicates in favor of his brother. His brother hasn't been consulted. When the brother is consulted, he says, I don't think so. I'm not going to take over. So Russia becomes a republic by accident, meaning no monarchy. The 300-plus-year-old Romanov dynasty ends because Nicholas abdicated at the last second in favor of his brother, not his son.
With the Mikhail Grand Duke?
Yes, okay. Exactly right.
So stop there for a moment. If Mikhail had said, thank you, Nicholas. All my life I've sort of wished I had been born first. This is a great job.
Yes.
The generals would have rallied. This would have stopped the revolution.
We don't know, of course, because that's a counterfactual, but it's an interesting thought you've just had. The generals thought that Alexei, who was a kind of cherubic young teenage boy, would rally the nation. That they would see this guy Alexei and they'd say, let's be patriotic.
Such a sympathetic character,
right. Whether Mikhail had the political touch or not. You know, political touch is a gift, and you either have it or you don't. In one of our famous political families here in the United States, one of them, the male, had the political touch, and we see the other one, the female, lacks the political touch. She just doesn't have it. And it's visible every day, right? And then voters can see whether you have. So whether Mikhail was up to the task of stepping in Nicholas II's shoes, had he had that ambition, is unclear to me. But nonetheless, the intention was not to validate the garrison's revolt in the capital, but instead to restore order, win the war on the Eastern Front against Germany and Austria, and survive.
This is a conservative, an attempt at a conservative revolution.
Now, the Duma faction that the generals latch onto, Nicholas has never liked the Duma. He conceded it grudgingly in 1906. He's been trying, scheming with various courtiers to abolish it. He prorogues the Duma during the war, which means he just says, you don't need to meet. Go home. I'll handle the war myself.
Don't call us. We'll call you.
Yes, that's exactly right. And so they're kind of itching because they feel that they can do a better job with the war effort than Nicholas can. And also they're in favor of a constitutional monarchy, meaning where they themselves had the kind of power that you have, like in Britain, for example, where the parliament is supreme. And so they're ambitious in the Duma. They collude with the generals. They take over and form something called the Provisional Government. The Provisional Government, the downfall of the Tsar, sometimes known as the February Revolution, but because they have a different calendar in Eastern Orthodoxy, it actually takes place in March on the Western calendar. But it's known as the February Revolution. So here we have no more Tsar. The generals are now going to continue to fight the war effort. The Duma is going to try to rule. But in fact, the provisional government, the members of the Duma that have announced themselves as provisional, they're provisional because they're supposed to be a constitutional convention.
Right.
And that's going to validate their power. But in the meantime, they're provisional. They don't call the Duma into session. So the members of the Duma that had been prorogued by Nicholas II conduct themselves a coup against their own Duma and rule as a self-appointed body, kind of French Revolution style. They're unable to win the war. They continue the war. They can't fix the food crisis because the war is a difficult problem to manage. A total war, one society against another society, mobilization of all resources, problems with transport, problems with getting the grain to the cities and to the army, you know, because armies and cities don't grow their own grain.
The army was, as I recall, they had by this time roughly 3 million men deployed. Is that the right number?
You have about 5 million at the peak.
Okay.
And you have 15 million who serve in the army at any given point during the
war. So at a very minimum, they have to solve the problem of feeding 5 million men.
And then the industrial cities need food, because the reason that there was an uprising in the capital, which the generals then were motivated to take Nicholas down, was because the women were marching for bread. It wasn't just the workers striking in the factories. And so what you've got here is you've got a difficult wartime situation that the self-appointed men of the provisional government are not up to handling. The provisional government goes through several incarnations, including Alexander Kerensky, who becomes the prime minister, the head of it, in the middle here. We're talking about the summer of 1917. Kerensky will eventually go into exile and spend the rest of his life here at the Hoover Institution with an office on the second floor of the Hoover Tower, writing his memoirs about how it wasn't his fault. But in the meantime, the war's going on, and they decide to go on the offensive. Even though the army is in rags, and they don't have enough rifles, and there's all sorts of other problems, they decide to go on the offensive. The offensive works a little bit at first, but then the soldiers decide they don't want to do it. They essentially have a soldier strike. The offensive fails. The provisional government is on the verge of dissolution. And at this point, Stalin's going to enter the picture, because these ragtag underground revolutionaries who are in far-off Siberia or European exile, once the Tsar falls and freedom is declared, they flock back to the capital, Petrograd, and they make their own plans for revolution. And that's where you're going to get the October coup in 1917.
Which is a coup.
There's no question it's a coup, yes.
All right. So 1917, the second revolution, the coup takes place. Lenin stands by himself. He's clearly the acknowledged leader of this. But then in the next level, you've got Stalin, Trotsky, Bukharin, Rykov, Zinoviev, Kamenev, others, Kaganovich.
Yes.
So Stalin at this point in 1917 is one of a dozen, 18 people under Lenin. And within 5 years, he becomes the undisputed dictator of this country. How did that happen?
Yeah, thank you. That's a really big story too, Peter. So what we have here is...
By the way, he's still fairly young by...
Yeah, born in 1878, so he's 39 years old in 1917, right. About to be 39. He's close to Lenin. Lenin is his meal ticket. Lenin is his mentor. Stalin, early on, his first meetings with Lenin, he's actually not that impressed. This is information that will subsequently be suppressed by the Soviet authorities, but we now have it again. Nonetheless, he hitches his wagon to Lenin. And Lenin, as you said, is the singular figure. He's the guy that's going to take these people to power. Will, determination, but also tactical flexibility. What people don't understand about Lenin is that he had very deep ideas that he would not relinquish. But he was willing to do whatever was necessary in order to realize those ideas, including repudiate those ideas for a time, what we call ultimate tactical flexibility. And Stalin went to school. He studied Lenin. He became Lenin's pupil. There are a handful of people around Lenin. Stalin is not alone. But there are only four people inside the inner regime already from October, November, 1917. And Stalin is one of those four people.
And these four people, we get limited from a dozen or half dozen to four because Lenin effectively selects them.
Yes, he does. And they're Trotsky, somebody named Yakov Sverdlov, who's going to die in 1919, looks like from disease.
There's an actual epidemic. Natural death, one of the few in your book. All right.
Yes, so there's an epidemic. He dies from disease in 1919. He's the kind of Stalin before Stalin in many ways. He's a great organizer. He's not really a public speaker. He's not really a charismatic figure, but he gets things done. He's a doer, a practical type. Sverdlov, Stalin, Trotsky, and Lenin. This is your regime in 1917. They're the ones empowered to sign government decrees, and they're the ones who meet most often with Lenin and are closest to Lenin. So what we have is Sverdlov's going to die, as we said, in 1919. Trotsky, Stalin, and Lenin. Nobody thinks that Lenin is going anywhere. It's clear that he's the acknowledged leader by everybody. It's clear that he has these political capabilities. He makes a lot of mistakes, and he does things that...
Still relatively young, vigorous. There's no cloud of ill health.
Correct. But it turns out he's got several illnesses, debilitating illnesses, and he's going to pass from the scene. So people often ask him, Peter, when does Stalin get in power? When does Stalin become a dictator? And I think that's an excellent question. I tried to answer it in the book, once again, with the original primary documents, only taking stuff that was said in real time and following closely the levers of power. So what happens is Lenin, who's the head of the government, which means he's kind of the equivalent of prime minister, chairman of the Council of People's Commissars, or the government in the Soviet case, commissars instead of ministers. Lenin appoints Stalin General Secretary of the Communist Party. Now, this is a new position, entirely new, that he's created only for Stalin. Mm-hmm. It's clear that Lenin's done this. We have the documents in his hand. It's clear that he's chosen Stalin. It's clear that he knows what he's doing. Stalin is already performing these functions for Lenin, right-hand man, organizer, head of the party, while Lenin runs the government and makes the big policy decisions. This happens in April 1922. So the Civil War has happened. The Reds have won the Civil War. Trotsky's had a prominent role as the head of the army, the commissar for war. Everybody knows Trotsky.
That's very interesting because Trotsky is not only an intellectual and an orator. He's the flashy figure.
Yes.
But it turns out he is able to take this ragtag operation, this failure that the Germans smashed,
yes,
and turned them into an effective fighting force as the Red Army, and he's brutal.
Yes, Trotsky.
So he's a doer and a talker.
Trotsky is effective during the Civil War. There's
okay.
no question.
Okay.
But once again, under Lenin's leadership.
All right.
Stalin has a very prominent role in the Civil War, too, not as prominent as Trotsky's role. And Stalin is not as well known as Trotsky. But in terms of being close to Lenin, Stalin is at least as close to Lenin, if not more, than Trotsky is. And Lenin relies on both of them. But in April 1922, Lenin makes Stalin General Secretary of the Communist Party.
Right.
Trotsky remains the war commissar at this point. Now, the Communist Party is, in many ways, the ideological and personnel heart of the regime. And so it's a very important position. Stalin will begin to take the position seriously and make it into something and create a personnel machine and an ideological machine, which doesn't really yet exist. This is something he's got to create. Remember, dictatorship is a creation, right? It's something that you've got to make and sustain. It's an achievement. It's not something that just happens. But what happens? Stalin appointed General Secretary of the Party in April 1922, and in May 1922, Lenin has a stroke. He has a debilitating stroke. So the number one guy has a stroke, and the number two guy, who was never intended by Lenin to be number one because Lenin didn't intend to step aside, is all of a sudden in this position where he's got the levers of power in his hands. The General Secretary of the Party controls the liaison with the secret police, controls the liaison with the military, controls the liaison with foreign policy, with the embassies abroad, has the cipher codes, communicates all the information to the local party organizations around the country, receives all the secret information. So it's the clearinghouse, it's the center of power, because the Communist Party, right, was loyal, was trusted, was the movement, was what Lenin relied on. Now, Stalin could have said, you know, this is not right. It's unfair to me. It's unfair to the other guys that I have all of this power all of a sudden. Should I control the secret police by myself? That's not fair. Why don't I share? Should I control all the cipher codes by myself? Why not share? In other words, Stalin could have been a different kind of personality. He could have been self-effacing. He could have been more collegial. But instead, of course, he was who we know he came to be. Ruthless, cunning, ambitious. And so he grabs these levers that have been put into his hands by Lenin, and with Lenin's stroke, Stalin's going to create a personal dictatorship inside the Bolshevik dictatorship.
Mm-hmm.